Jo Wright, and this is the Coaching Culture Podcast, where we discuss how to make work better. Hello, and welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast. My name's Jo Wright, and today I've got another wonderful guest. I'm really privileged to have my guest here with us today, and that is the wonderful John Williams, who's the CEO of the Institute of Leadership and Management. So welcome to today, John. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you very much indeed, Jo. It's an absolute delight to be here with you for a chat.
Oh, thanks, John. And the reason I've invited you today is because we've talked in the past. You're one of our judges for our Super Coaching Culture Awards evenings. Indeed. And we just really wanted to, we very much share the same thoughts and feelings about how important leaders are in organisations and the difference they can make to the culture and the people around them. So today we're going to have a great conversation about all things leadership.
Yep.
So, John, before we make a start, tell us a little bit about yourself and your story. I always find that an interesting first question because people like to know the human behind the title.
Yeah, sure. Well, I can't say that I've got what might be called a textbook career or any of that sort of stuff, because I started from school when I didn't get any of my A levels. I didn't go and do a first degree or anything like that. I didn't do my MBA until I was nearly 50. So I had a very diverse career, I think. I did lots of stuff at the front end, which was sort of things like, you know, like working on a building site and electrician's mate and glazier and stuff like this. And then I got a job in a suit. And actually, it was by accident almost. I got a job in the back office of a stockbroker's firm in Newcastle. It was the first time I'd ever had a job where I wore a suit to work. And it was the first time I'd ever had a job where I was actually indoors all the time. And it was a revelation to me the way that offices worked and the hierarchy in offices worked. And that was the first place that I suppose I saw leadership being exemplified or being exhibited in a lot of ways. And it was interesting because stockbroking, which was where I started, was one of those milieus where you only have two types of people. You have the partners and the peasants. Everybody else was a peasant. And the partners were expected to provide leadership. And, you know, in those days, of course, they didn't. They just dispensed orders like largesse to a grateful public and stuff like this. And as I moved then through my career at other office jobs, I discovered actually that there is two things, really. One is there's a difference between, of course, leadership and management. And we sort of intuitively recognize that. But sometimes people differ in their definitions of it. And the second and most important thing was, actually, sometimes it's not done very well, whether it's leadership or management. And I think my career, but as it progressed from stockbroking through all sorts of things, banking, I owned my own company in Hong Kong for a little while. Wow. I did a lot of work in the Middle East. I was a civil servant for about 6 years, running international trade support, lots and lots of different jobs. And I think the benefit of that, I suppose I'd say I was a millennial about 30 years too early. The benefit of that was that I was part of lots of different structures, organizational structures, and I could see examples of what worked and what didn't work in those various organizational structures. So as I came towards the latter half of my career, where I was privileged to be in leadership positions and also developing other leaders, it gave me an opportunity to think about, well, how should this be done in order to help them be better leaders in the future? And I ended up doing exactly that in the role that I do now with the Institute.
Oh, wow. This feels like your whole career has just sort of led you to this point now where you are, I suppose, influencing the shape of leadership around the world.
Well, I would love to think it's around the world. I think it's a very small part of the world at the moment. Our ambition, of course, is that it should be the rest of the world. Yeah. I think you're right. I mean, I probably, if I was honest, I'd probably say I've waited, you know, 30 years for this job, because it's exactly the sort of thing I like to do, which is essentially helping more people become better leaders more of the time.
Brilliant. Definitely. And that is a great and worthy pursuit for anybody. And I think that does sound like you've had the great learnings of, as well along the way that, you know, I'm loving the partners and the peasants. I mean, how shocking is that, to be fair? Shocking. It's like upstairs, downstairs.
Yes.
So in terms of the partners and the peasants, so in terms of leadership then, so what have been your greatest lessons in what makes a great leader? So obviously you've experienced it yourself. You are now in a position to influence many others to support them in their leadership and management style. Mm-hmm. What have you seen and how has it changed? Obviously, it's definitely not partners and peasants anymore.
No.
The world's changing. So what have you seen? What have you experienced, John, over the years?
Well, it's really interesting.
Where are we now, I guess?
Where are we now? It's a good question, because certainly the partners and the peasantry has been left behind completely, a long way behind. And I think in answer to the question about the leadership lessons, in a way, we start with what do we mean by leadership? How do we define leadership? And of course, there are grillions of definitions of leadership out there. And I favor one which is very straightforward and yet very demanding of leaders. And that is leadership is the achievement of an outcome that cannot be better achieved any other way. Because if it can be better achieved any other way, then somebody else should be the leader. So this is hugely demanding of leaders. Yeah. And consequently, the things that we learn, that reminds me of a lovely phrase, the things that we need to learn before we can do them, we learn by doing them. And in a way, that beautifully exemplifies leadership.
Good.
It's great, isn't it? It really is. And I think that the lessons that I've learned have been, as usual, have been the hard ones, because we very rarely learn lessons from our successes. We learn lessons from our failures or things like this. And we have five values that we promote in the Institute, leadership values. They are authenticity, vision, ownership, collaboration, and achievement. And I think if I used a couple of those examples for areas where I've learned a lesson, one of them, and it's this very commonly used word, authenticity. It's the need to be ourselves. And I remember I worked for Santander, actually, the bank, for about four and a bit years. And I am not a banker. I'm not trained as a banker. I don't have the 100% commercial approach that people associate with banks and with bankers. And I needed still to be me, which is, you know, somebody who is interested more in the customer than in the employer and stuff like this. And it was actually quite challenging. At the same time, though, what it taught me was that if I remain authentically me, then some people will not just accept that, they will actually understand why that can be positive and productive, even in a milieu like banking, where being authentically me might not necessarily produce the commercial outcome that people expected. The other one was the collaboration, the principle of collaboration. I came to work in London from the northeast of England about 10, 12 years ago, something like that. And I'd been to London loads of times and I thought I knew my way around London and all this sort of stuff. Of course, arriving to work in London, especially I was chief exec of an inward investment agency, I needed to have a network, which I didn't have at the time. And I needed to develop that network, because promoting an area for inward investment, one needs to get collaboration from all the businesses, the public sector, the universities, everybody else. And I needed to develop that collaboration. So that was really challenging for me. I ran that organization for a few years, and the first 6 or 8 months was just creating the network to collaborate. And I learned that the lesson I learned there was, it doesn't matter how smart I might think I am, I need other people to help me achieve as a leader. And the last one is around achievement. And it takes time. this is probably the most important lesson of any leadership. Stuff takes time. And, you know, when I was for 6.5 years, I was the international trade director for what's now the Department for International Trade in the northeast of England. And it took me 2 years to build the structure there that I really needed to have. And it nearly drove me mad, because I'm not a person who's patient, and waiting 2 years for something to happen you know, wasn't me. And yet it needed to be done. So a couple of lessons there, really challenge lessons that I learned. I suppose the underlying lesson is you can't have it all your own way just because you've got leadership in your title or in your position.
Absolutely. I think the things you've said there, and, you know, the authenticity is coming up time and time again, isn't it? And, you know, people being themselves, and what does that actually mean? What do they, who do they want to bring to work, and, and be allowed to, because if people are battling not being authentically themselves, they're wasting a lot of energy on trying to be somebody else, which that feels pointless. Collaboration, absolutely. I mean, I can see that, you know, here at Coaching Culture, needing other people to support your journey, your vision, and having, I suppose, the confidence to reach out for support, to be able to collaborate with others, whether that's internally or externally. I find that a lot more, you know, the need to work with others, because we can't do everything ourselves at all, and having to kind of get more people bought in, and achievements and things taking longer than you think, is, I think is so true, especially where people are concerned. When you're winning hearts and minds, changing mindsets, changing behaviours, this all takes time. I always find leading people, it's like conducting an orchestra, and just as you've got, you know, the orchestra over there beautifully playing a tune, you've got something crashing in the corner. Absolutely. You know, it's whether it's the cymbals or actually it's not quite going to, it's just like this all the time, and that all takes time, doesn't it, to get it right. You can't just bring a load of orchestra players together and expect them to get it straight off.
That's absolutely right. And two things in that. One is that that word confidence, and I think we need to often as leaders, we need to have the confidence to be patient. The second thing is that the point that you make about orchestras don't just happen. There's a principle in agile leadership around self-organizing teams. And I often say self-organizing teams don't. They don't self-organize at all.
Self-organizing sounds chaos.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in a way, this is, we come back to this definition of leadership, of trying to achieve something as a result that couldn't be better achieved. Actually, the reason why we have leadership figures is because self-organizing teams don't self-organize. There needs to be some real outcome focus for people to understand how they can organize.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because I had a conversation a while ago, actually, with Perry Timms, who's also on our, who's our chair of our awards for the Coaching Culture Judging. And he talks about self-management and kind of removing hierarchies and all that. It was quite an interesting conversation that he feels that organisations are moving a little bit more towards, whether it's now or certainly for the future, that actually there's more of a self-management. And it is back to, I suppose, the agile way of working. We had quite an interesting conversation about it. It's a different way. It's certainly way from the partners and the peasants model of years gone by.
Totally, yeah. And actually, it's light years away from the command and control with which many leadership figures are still not just associated, but attached to. Because a hierarchy, one of the things a hierarchy does is it gives people permission to give orders. And of course, for those people, the power is for those people who have permission to give orders. Oh, it's very reassuring and quite pleasing, actually, to be able to do this sort of stuff. But then suddenly, and this is one of the biggest things that's changed during and since the pandemic, is the need to be able to say, because we haven't got everybody, you know, for 2 years, we didn't have everybody sitting in the office in front of us waiting for us to point and say, you do this. Actually, that hierarchical approach has begun to break down more actively than it's ever done before. And with very good reason, because people are starting to realize it's the outcome of work that matters rather than being able to see where everybody's sitting and make sure that they're on the phone all day and all of that sort of stuff. And this results orientated approach, rather than I can't see you, therefore I don't know what you're up to, is one of the ways in which leadership has positively changed since the onset of the pandemic, I think.
Absolutely. And I think there's a word here that it boils down to, and that's trust, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Trust.
Yeah.
If you can trust in your leaders to set the right vision, the you know, strategic view of the future, and then organize ourselves in a way that achieves that, and then the leaders trusting their teams and the teams trusting each other to get on with it and get it done because you're all in it together, you've got a winning formula right there.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, trust is something which is, I suppose I would describe as reciprocal. So there's a requirement for the leadership to demonstrate trust in their teams first, in order for the teams to become trustworthy, if you like, but also to trust those leaders to have that leadership position, albeit not hierarchically, just maybe as a, I think of leaders now as being their requirement, our requirement is to provide clarity and focus and compassion, I guess, really.
Definitely. And that, I mean, the compassion card has definitely gone wolf, hasn't it? In terms of, we were recognizing the need for focus on well-being. I didn't hear the word compassionate leadership quite as much as I have since throughout the pandemic and since, to be fair. And I think, you know, like I said, we were definitely focusing on well-being and all the great things that were, but actually it has boiled down to compassion, hasn't it, and empathetic and all those great words that aren't fluffy. They're there, they're about human to human relationships.
Absolutely right. And you know, these are the things that used to be called soft skills but are really hard-edged, actually. And the thing I like about the word compassion is that it holds a quality of active understanding rather than well-being. And I can be pretty passive about well-being, and I can hand that off to somebody else. You know, we have consultants who help our well-being and stuff. Actually, I need to be compassionate as an individual. I need to be empathetic. I actively need to be sympathetic, actually, to some of the challenges that people face. So, yeah, I think compassion is one of those, what's the word, unexpected qualities of leadership. And when I say unexpected, I mean it wasn't in the manual 10 or 15 years ago that, okay, you've also got to be compassionate, because that didn't look as though it did anything for results when it does.
Oh, it does everything for results. And and all the conversations I have on these podcasts all lead to, you know, look after your people and the results will follow. And that's a quote from Casper Craven, who's also talking at our conference. Yep. Feels like some giant plug for the conference, and it's not meant to be. But they're all, it's all linking to what matters in the workplace, not, you know, and what does get results. Because obviously we're all here for positive results, which enables growth and reinvestment in people and reinvestment in businesses and communities. But this all leads back to, you know, a different style of leadership required, because employees' needs are changing. We cannot stay back in the dark ages of command and control. And it's really interesting, because we get to speak to some fabulous organizations, fabulous people, and you know, where sometimes people would maybe think the military is command and control, actually we have some fabulous conversations within the military on coaching style of leadership, on actually how much further forward they are. And the NHS as well. I was on a podcast last week with a senior consultant of cardiology, and he coaches people while he's got his hands in people's arteries.
Yes.
And I was like, what? Surely that is not a coaching moment.
Well, it's really interesting, this, because the two examples you mentioned, the military and the NHS, they are two really very clearly outcome-orientated organizations. They're not process-focused. You know, you can't have detailed, granular rules for what happens in an emergency situation. We have protocols for how we respond to an emergency, but when you get right down to having your hands inside somebody's body, or you're under fire in somewhere dangerous, actually you can't open the rule book and say, what am I supposed to do if there's four bullets coming from over there and only three from over there? So the idea of having I think clarity and focus on the mission, the outcome that one wants, and flexibility in the way that people get there. And that comes back to your point about trust. Did we help develop them to the degree where we can trust them to make all of the right decisions? Because if we didn't, that's our fault, not theirs. And this responsibility, this ownership, one of our five values for leaders, is owning the outcome. Not saying, oh, well, look, guys, you know, I was expecting the team to do a bit better than this. You didn't. Actually, if the team didn't do well enough, that's down to me. I'm supposed to be, in a 100%. Sense, helping the team to achieve the things that I want them to achieve. And if they don't, the failure is down to the leader, not to the team.
100%. I so agree. And I think that once leaders and managers, I guess, recognize the need, their responsibility when they're leading or managing people is to help others develop and be the best selves. Yep. And if they're not being the best selves, what have we as leaders and managers failed to do? Yeah. What have we not done? Yep. Let's hold the mirror up to us rather than just flick the blame, the you know, criticism. Actually, what have we not done to help that person become the best? Because everybody's got more within them, haven't they? And everybody with clarity and focus can develop.
Well, it's interesting because one of the many, many jobs that I had, and I've had lots of jobs, I was a consultant with a consultancy firm, and it lasted about a year or so. Yeah. And at the end of it, when I left, that we did an exit interview with the senior partner. And I'll never forget, the first question he asked me was, where did we go wrong? And I thought, what a tremendous question. He didn't blame me for the fact that I was leaving or whatever. He said, where did we go wrong? And that really stuck with me as one of those taking ownership of the outcome moments, which was really, really good.
Well, we're here, don't we, that people leave their managers, not their organisations. Yes. So it is often about that, isn't it? It's about that vital relationship in an organisation.
Yep.
And trust in leadership, I think, to know that actually we're all going in that right direction.
Yeah, that's right. And interestingly enough, people ask me quite often, who's doing it right? Who's getting it right, John? Who can we learn from?
Well, that was going to be my next question.
What? Oh, right. Okay, great. Well, my answer to that...
That was going to be my next.
Yeah, my answer to that is probably not very helpful, by which I mean I don't have any examples to give. And the reason why I don't have any examples to give is actually relatively straightforward. All the principles and the activities of leadership are very complex. And when I say complex, I mean different from complicated, because if something is complicated, like building a car is very complicated. I don't know how to do it. However, given the manual and the bits, eventually I could probably put it together if I did it all in the right order and stuff like that. So the outcome of something that's complicated is nevertheless predictable if the instructions are followed in the right way. The outcome of something complex is that it's unpredictable. So we can do something. It's a bit like, you know, things like chaos theory. We can speak to the same person in exactly the same way about the same situation, in the same situation, a second time, and the outcome will be different. They'll be in a different mood. The weather will be different. The time of day will be different. People are complex. So we cannot actually predict what the outcome is going to be. So actually, to say so-and-so gets it right, Amazon gets it right, Facebook gets it right, some, I don't know, BP gets it right, whoever it is, actually, what they do is right for them at a particular time. We can never say we should try the same thing as they're doing. We can, of course, and this is where leadership becomes a case of applying judgment to our experience, we can say, here's a couple of good ideas that I've read about. For example, let's be compassionate as leaders. Okay, I think that's an exemplar. I will follow that. I have to interpret that in my own judgment, in my own organization, because I have to be aware that there is nobody out there that's doing something to a template that I can then just lay over my organization and get the same result. This is why leaders get
every
paid.
Every organization's different.
Yeah, absolutely. And
good money.
And yeah, one would hope enough to make it worthwhile. Not always the case, I have to admit. One would hope it's enough to make it worthwhile taking the risk of the responsibility of leadership. And I have to say that people have said to me, you know, anybody can be a leader. Well, everybody has leadership qualities. Not everybody can be a leader in any situation, because some situations require, you know, different qualities of leadership. Sometimes you want somebody who is incredibly decisive instantaneously, because, you know, the situation deserves that. Other times you want somebody who says, that's great, let me think about it, and will be reflective, and so on. So, you know, it's very difficult to say this is an example of how leadership should be done. We can just pick examples of behaviors at a given moment, try them out, and see if they work for us. Accepting, and I'll say this and then I'll shut up, accepting that even if we do the same thing at the same in the same situation in future, the outcome is going to be different, because the people and the time and the situation itself will be different.
It's really interesting, because I often reflect on my own style of leadership, and I know when I'm absolutely at my best, and I know when I'm not at my best, and I know what drives that. I know and it's interesting. It's often, you know, the environment, situations, responding/reacting to kind of what other things have happened, and then when I need others to, I need others to lean on. It's really I reflect all the time, and building a business that I've never done before like this is really challenging. And, you know, I know I'm at my best when things are going great, but sometimes if it's not quite as good, it's like, oh, you know, I start having sleepless nights, which then impacts me the day after.
Absolutely.
It's fascinating.
Absolutely. And I think you're a good example of somebody who retains the energy and enthusiasm to keep going in what is essentially a startup. And people say to me, oh, I'm not a startup. I've been going for 3 years. 3 years, one is still a startup. Every day we are a startup, no matter what. And we have to retain that energy and resilience, which is another leadership quality, because there is no 100%. Steady state template of leadership that will fit any organization. It's a bit like imposter syndrome made large, because actually all of us are making it up every single day. Really.
I like to call it every day's a school day.
Absolutely.
Every day, it's like,
exactly.
I don't know the answer, but we'll figure it out somehow.
Absolutely.
Asking the right questions in a compassionate way. No, you're so right. And, you know, we are, you know, here at Coaching Culture, every day has been a school day. And there's some days that are easier school days, like they were at school. And there's some days that are harder school days, like there was at school. That makes it part of the challenge and the excitement. But you do need a lot of energy. I've always been quite energetic, but I need extra reserves of energy, because you're responsible for so many people and their families and it's fascinating.
It is, and also, and this brings us back to this,
and a privilege,
that's right, it brings us back to this point about compassion. We need to be compassionate also about ourselves, because I coach marathon runners. Nobody can run at top speed all the time. We do need to rest. We do need to take a break. And that idea of some R&R becomes even more important at the leadership level, because of that additional responsibility and ownership that we take. And it's like, you know, I say to athletes, we do not improve when we are training. Our bodies do not improve when they are training. They improve when we are resting. Yeah. So it's the same for our minds.
Absolutely. It really, really is. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because I had a fabulous, again, conversation recently with the wonderful Kelly Swingler all about burnout. And actually the signs, people don't just wake up burnt out. There's so many stages and then suddenly crash. And the body just caves in. And you're right. I think, you know, there's some highly responsible leadership roles. You know, who's looking after the leaders of the organisations, you know, because it is a responsibility. as well as a privilege. It kind of it's like the same on the weighing scales, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I so agree.
That's why I'm having a week off next week, John.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the way I describe it is, with the cloak of authority come the lead boots of responsibility. We can't avoid having both.
Totally agree. I totally agree. That's a brilliant analogy. No, absolutely. It's about being mindful. Otherwise, you know, as people say, you can't, you know, you can't help others if you're not helping yourself and all that kind of stuff. My team and I, we kind of do it all together. We all sort of get, bring each other up. We're in it together. And if one of us is having a great day, somebody else may not be. So we help. It's just like a constant sort of... I suppose an algorithm of different, you know, because everybody's got different things going on in life.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And we recognise it's not what's just going on at work.
Yeah, that's right. And the concept of team, in a way, you know, this idea of a team, but people often talk about a sales team, for example. Well, sometimes actually a sales team is not a team. If each of those people in the group is targeted individually, then they will be competing with each other. Actually, a team is just a team if it has a common outcome to achieve, so that each member of the team recognizes I can contribute this and I need to help the others if they are, if their contribution is falling down for any reason, because we as a team achieve, not us individually. And that, and that's a great ethos for a leader to develop, actually.
Definitely. And I think organisations are really waking up to the value of teams. They've they've known about leadership for a long time, even though it may not have been, you know, oh, I'll stick somebody on a leadership development tick. There we go. That's not the answer. It's that constant feedback, that constant culture of support, and having these conversations like we're having now about what is required and how people can develop those skills. But that, I think organisations are really focusing a lot more on teams now. In a good way, that they're realizing they're made up of many, many teams that create their own little subcultures. Well, actually, what does that look like on a whole organization? I love having the team and leadership conversations. It's fascinating.
Well, it is. And what is, for me, in some ways, is the most interesting about this is there's only room for one culture in an organization. Of course, you know, each team can have its own culture at its level. However, the culture of the organization, there's only room for one. It might be command and control. It might be purely commercial and we don't care about the customer as long as they're paying us money. It might be that we're a charity and we exist to do good works. Whatever it is, that culture will pervade everything that everybody does. And it's a bit like a sense of humor. When somebody joins a group, if their sense of humor is different from the group, either their sense of humor will change or they will leave the group. Because sense of humor is something which really defines a group. The same is true of culture in organizations. And the number of times I've been in an organization where somebody has joined who's had a much more brutally commercial culture, for example, they've come from a, you know, an insurance sales team or something like this, and they've come in shouting and bawling and doing stuff, and actually they don't last very long. Because what actually the culture we have in our organization is that we have a team outcome and we all help each other achieve it. So it's very important to recognize there's only one culture in our organizations and we need to know what that culture is.
I'll tell you something we've done recently, John, is rather than identifying at coaching culture here our kind of values, we've been around now for 5 years and it takes time to create who you are, what do we stand for. You know, it's lovely to have it ideal on sort of our ideas in our mind, but actually who are we? What are the people who we know succeed in the business? And we've now developed something called culture codes. Rather than values, we've got culture codes, which are, we have lots of them, so 20-something culture codes, because they're the small, subtle principles of how we are around here. Rather than a number of values that we may put on the wall, they're culture codes. And some of them stand out more than others, but they're little quirky phrases that if somebody says the phrase, you remember it and you know what it stands for, and we all align ourselves to it. And we introduced them earlier this year, and you know, and the team, and it's through working with the team that we know we can develop them.
Yeah.
But I think culture codes are something quite interesting. And they evolve, they're dynamic. So actually, mm-hmm. we're realizing that some are mattering now more than others, or there's some probably some new ones that are becoming more obvious, you know, because we're in a different moment in time. Oh, so that's lovely. Quite interesting, is culture yeah. codes.
I think that's fascinating. And this is what I get for talking about culture to somebody who runs an organization called Coaching Culture. I drop myself in a hole, you see. Now, what I like about this is when I mentioned, you know, there's only one culture in an organization, that doesn't mean it's fixed. It has to be dynamic. No. You know, one might have an organization where the culture is defensive, because we haven't been doing very well for some years and we just want to stay not doing any worse. And then actually things get better. We want to be, growth focused and stuff like this, which is a much more positive culture and stuff like that. And I like this idea of having a cascade of culture codes within that, which people can use actually to respond to and manage situations. And it's interesting you say phrases. There are two phrases I remember particularly from my career. One was the worst piece of advice I've ever had, which was hurry up. That somebody said that to me and it stuck in my head. So I spent the next 10 years in a hurry. And then the other phrase is when somebody says, I don't care. That's an absolutely stunning indication of abdication, dislocation, the lack of the opposite of ownership, if you like, really. And I always, when I hear phrases like that, I'm always really suddenly galvanized to say, okay, let's just, let's stop right there and let's unpack what you've just said and understand why you said that.
Yeah, fascinating. Brilliant. So where do you see things going? So let's wind forward to the future.
Yep.
We've got our crystal ball. What are you seeing that either needs to change or that actually organisations are moving on that journey? So let's wind forward, 10, 20 years. Where are we and what will leadership look like in the future?
Okay, well, I can easily predict what will happen 10 or 20 years in the future because nobody will remember what I've said, so I can say anything I like, really, that sort of stuff. However,
you don't know. Well, this might come back to us in 20 years and go, it never happened. Right. You're not Nostradamus.
Williams, you said in 2022. Well, it's interesting because I remember people have heard me say this before. Jeff Bezos says we should focus on the things that don't change. So consumers will always want lower prices and faster delivery. Okay, well, that's interesting because if we think about leadership, what are the things that won't change about leadership that we need to then focus on? Well, it's interesting because one of the things is exactly what we're talking about now, which is future readiness. Because we do expect vision and prediction from our leaders. So I'll say something which is incredibly trite and glib, which is the future is full of opportunities and challenges, same as it ever was, actually. However, because of that, and because we don't know what those opportunities and challenges will be, then actually what we need to cultivate is the agility to adapt and respond to whatever happens. So for me, the future of leadership is all about acquiring qualitative agility. So that's both in the leaders themselves and in the way that they help to develop future leaders. So principles around rapid adaptation, around understanding what's going on in the market, around analytics to help us do that, around prediction, not predicting 5 or 10 years away, but just predicting what next looks like. Forget good. I don't care what. See, I don't care. I said I don't care. I don't care what good looks like, but I do care what next looks like. So stuff like that. So for me, the future for organizations is predicated upon how agile those organizations become.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I like that. There's got to be something in there. So it's about having the ability to flex and move and respond to what happens. I mean, nobody was predicting apart from Bill Gates maybe, but nobody was apparently predicting a global pandemic in 2020. Yeah. But it's about, and therefore the style that needs to go with whatever that whatever we respond to in the world. They need to, like now it's compassionate leadership, which is really, really important because people are still feeling sore from the last 2 years or so, aren't they? Bruised,
indeed.
So I suppose it's that agile way, but actually you've also got to have a responding style of what does that mean to my people?
Well, it's really interesting because I my team are tired of my using this analogy. I use the analogy of a cheetah when I talk about agility because people think cheetah runs at like 70 miles an hour and that's the fastest land animal.
Yep.
And okay, that's incredibly impressive. However, that's not how the cheetah manages to catch gazelles because they can run very fast as well. So what differentiates the cheetah is not its speed, it's its ability to change direction at speed. That's what's important. And because the cheetah learns, and the cheetah has to learn because otherwise they'd all die out, the cheetah learns that there are a limited number of moves that a gazelle can make in order to get away from a cheetah. You know, it can turn left or right or go up a bit or whatever.
Yeah.
So the cheetah learns the pattern of movement of the gazelle. So at some point or other, the cheetah recognizes the next move this gazelle makes will be X. I will make that move first. So when the gazelle arrives at that point, the cheetah is there waiting for it. And it only needs to be a split second ahead of the movement. And this is what I call predictive agility or preemptive agility. It's the ability to say, actually, next will look like this. And this is what predictive analytics gives us. So the future for organizations depends upon their ability to analyze the data that they collect from the market and predict therefrom where the market will go next.
Yeah, love that. Love that. Although now I can't get out of my head a cheetah and a gazelle, so I need to unsee that in my mind. I've never been good at things like that on those nature programs. That is fabulous. Thank you. And in terms of anything else, any pieces of advice you'd like to share with our listeners today on kind of what they should be, apart from predictive agility and the compassionate leadership and authenticity, are there any sort of key nuggets of advice that people should be listening to today and thinking, yeah, you know what, we absolutely need to be looking at that to, you know, whether that's today, you know, what would you, as the CEO of the Institute of Leadership and Management, what would be your overarching advice to organizations listening today?
No pressure at all. Right. The two things then. The first one is I would say learn about and particularly learn how to use predictive analytics, because data is how we all make decisions. You know, we look out the window, that gives us data about whether or not it's raining and we can go out and stuff. So predictive analytics is a way of using data to help us make decisions for the future behavior and future activity. The second thing is what I suppose call smart curiosity. And the author, Simon Sinek, has made a great play of the question, why? Always ask why and stuff. And and I think asking that question will often identify for us what the problem is. Actually, to get to solutions, I think we should be asking why not. For example, business transformations often don't succeed. Why not? Business schools don't give us the leaders that we say we want. Why not? So focus on why things are not happening may enable us to achieve solutions, as opposed to just getting the right questions or identifying the right problems. Because, you know, it's great to identify the problem. It doesn't solve it.
Do you know, that's great. Nobody has ever said that to me. Why? No, actually, why don't I ask why not? Why not? Why not? I really like that. Because sometimes we avoid the word why, even though there's all the five whys and all that sort of thing. But sometimes, you know, I suppose in the coaching world, we avoid the why question, but actually we reframe it in a what question somehow. We sneakily do that. But why not? I like that. I like that. Thank you so much, John. I've absolutely loved our we have crammed in so much into 40 minutes there, haven't we?
We've covered
all sorts of stuff going on there with all sorts of different conversations. I really, really valued our conversation, and fascinating. You've covered so much ground there.
Wow.
Thank you very, very much. Is there anything else you'd like to share? Anything else at all?
Well, first of all, I'd say thank you very much indeed for the great conversation. It really is, has been really, really very, very entertaining, I think, for me as well as I hope for your listeners and stuff. The only thing I say is, I suppose really, there's a question I always say to people. If we don't know what to do, particularly as leaders, if we don't know what to do, just ask ourselves, what would I do if I was not afraid?
Oh,
and
we've got to
does,
finish there. That's it.
Yeah, it's enough, really, isn't it?
What would I do if I was not afraid?
Yeah.
What a fabulous coaching question to leave us on. Thank you so much, John, for your time. It's been an absolute delight. I've loved our conversation. Thank you.
My great, great pleasure. Thank you very much. And if anybody wants to contact me, I'm John Mark Williams on LinkedIn, and I'm always happy to have a discussion, argument, robust debate, whatever it is, about leadership.